Thanks for joining me. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. It's time to join Jill Bevilacqua as she presents a special feature focusing on pilgrimages.
Spring comes, and people wake out of their winter apathy and are stirred by a desire to go on pilgrimage.
When the sweet showers of April fall and shoot down through the drought of March to pierce the root, and the small fowl are making melody that sleep away the night with open eye, then people long to go on pilgrimages, and palmers long to seek the stranger strands of far-off saints, hallowed in sundry lands.
The opening lines of the prologue to Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. The pilgrims in the poem are travelling to the shrine of Thomas à Becket, martyred in Canterbury in 1170 and canonised a little over 2 years later. And as John Adair writes in The Pilgrim's Way,
"For more than 350 years, every English spring saw the roads of Canterbury thronged with pilgrims on foot or horseback, in litters or carriages."
The pilgrim of today doesn't have to wait for spring to make the journey, but can count on covered transport, whatever the season. In past centuries, pilgrimage was of necessity an open-air activity, dependent very much on good weather. If the outward manner or style of pilgrimage has changed, its essence has remained the same. It's still a journey to a holy place, undertaken, we may read, as an act of religious devotion, either simply in order to venerate it, or to ask the fulfilment of some need, or as an act of penance. Another motive quoted by some is, in order to acquire spiritual merit. In an article on the pastoral importance of shrines, Marist brother John Samaha writes,
"A pilgrimage is a journey by the faithful to a shrine, a place made sacred. Shrines, Pope John Paul reminded us in 1987, are like milestones that guide the journey of the children of God on earth."
Paul VI described shrines as spiritual clinics, testimonies of miraculous deeds, luminous stars in the church's sky. Though there's a vast number of shrines to choose from, the supreme pilgrimage can only be that made to the Holy Land, where pilgrims were going as early as the 3rd century. Writes Brother Samaha,
"The spirit of the early and medieval church inspired pilgrimages to Jerusalem and Bethlehem, to the tombs of the apostles and martyrs in Rome, and to churches and shrines holding relics of saints. Internationally famous in the Middle Ages were Santiago de Compostela in northwestern Spain and Canterbury in England."
The pilgrims of the past, as we know, endured all kinds of hardship and were exposed to many dangers en route. But we are not expected to emulate them, as the Catholic Encyclopedic Dictionary assures us.
"Contrary to some common notions, a pilgrimage is not necessarily penitential. It need not be performed under conditions of physical discomfort, with great solemnity, nor are ordinary means of travel, for example, by train or motor car, essentially out of harmony with it."
Today's common-sense approach allows the pilgrim to travel in reasonable comfort, without tarnishing the spiritual aspect of his undertaking. If his destination is overseas, he may go by plane, which will give him more time at the shrine itself. And wherever he goes, he will almost certainly walk the last mile or two in order to enter into the spirit of the place. Our pilgrim may go with a parish group on a package deal, or privately with family or friends, or even alone. But in the last analysis, the value of a pilgrimage will not depend on how or with whom we travel, but on the spirit in which we make it. As the anonymous 9th century Irish author put it, with reference to a pilgrim coming to Rome,
"The king whom you seek here, unless you bring him with you, you will not find him."
But let's take a look at how it used to be, how people prepared themselves, and what were the symbols in that golden age of pilgrimage.
"Give me my scallop shell of quiet, my staff of faith to walk upon, my scrip of joy, immortal diet, my bottle of salvation, my gown of glory, hope's true gauge, and thus I'll take my pilgrimage."
These are the opening lines of a poem entitled The Passionate Man's Pilgrimage at the Point of Death. It was written by Sir Walter Raleigh in 1603, the night before he was due to be executed. After Henry VIII's break with Rome and his massive destruction of shrines in England, the pilgrimage tradition had suffered a decline. As for pilgrimages to the Holy Land, they were, as one writer puts it, as out of date as the Crusades. But the images of pilgrimage lingered on in the national memory, echoes of the great season of pilgrimage, the Middle Ages. The universal sign of the pilgrim was the scallop shell. Symbol of the shrine of St. James of Compostela in Spain, it was originally worn to show that the pilgrim had completed a journey to that shrine. But, as Sarah Hopper writes in To Be a Pilgrim,
it came to be worn by any man or woman who had made pilgrimage to any venerated site in his native country or beyond. The scallop shell of St. James became such a well-recognised pilgrim token as to become the symbol of medieval pilgrimage as a whole.
Erasmus says that the scallop was adopted as the emblem of St. James of Compostela because the shore of that adjacent sea abounds in them. And Sarah Hopper writes,
scallops can be found from the southwest of England to the Iberian Peninsula, as well as on the Mediterranean and Atlantic coast of Morocco.
According to Brewer, the shrine of St. James was especially popular with English pilgrims. And in a note on the pilgrims' hats, sometimes referred to as cockle hats, he writes,
pilgrims used to wear cockle or scallop shells on their hats. The polished side of the shell was scratched with some crude drawings of the Virgin, the crucifixion, or some other object related to the pilgrimage. Being blessed by the priest, the shells were considered as amulets against spiritual foes and might be used as drinking vessels.
An essential item of the pilgrim's equipment was his staff, not only as a means of support, but also, if need be, of defence.
The staff often carried a single or double knob at the top, and most commonly a double-pronged iron spike at the bottom, probably to grip the ground when climbing. The pilgrim would also carry a scrip or leather satchel, usually suspended from a belt worn across the body. This would carry provisions and a water bottle, as well as the important pilgrim's letter of safe conduct signed by the church authorities.
Like the cockle shell, the scrip and staff became emblematic of pilgrimage. So significant were they for the individual pilgrim that not only were they fondly cherished as reminders of his great undertaking, but in many cases they were even buried with him. The German Dominican brother Felix Faber wrote that pilgrims bound for the Holy Land could be identified by four outward signs.
These were the red cross on a long grey gown, a black or grey hat with a red cross, a scrip and a long beard.
And women pilgrims? The traditional dress of the medieval pilgrim was very like what was worn generally in the England of the time, a long cloak over a tunic. But, as Sarah Hopper writes,
items that made this outfit unique to the pilgrim were a pair of sturdy boots for walking and a multifunctional broad-brimmed hat to protect against exposure to the sun, also useful for displaying souvenir badges. Important pilgrimage sites often sold souvenir badges that were mostly made of a tin-lead alloy or brass or clay. They were fitted with a pin or clasp so that the badge could be worn, and the surface was stamped with either a portrait of the saint, a scene from his life or death, or a symbol associated with him. Probably the most well-recognised and earliest pilgrim badge was the Palm of Jericho symbol, which pilgrims brought back from Jerusalem. It's from this symbol of the palm that the name Palmer for a professional pilgrim on perpetual pilgrimage came.
The dictionary defines palmer as an itinerant monk travelling from shrine to shrine under a vow of poverty. Originally, though, it referred to the ordinary pilgrim who brought back from the Holy Land the consecrated palm branch, which on his return he would lay on the altar of his parish church.
His sandals were with travel tore, staff, budget, bottle, scrip he wore. The faded palm branch in his hand showed pilgrim from the Holy Land.
Sir Walter Scott's Marmion. In 1808, when these lines were written, a budget was not what we mean by the word today, the Chancellor of the Exchequer's annual financial statement. It meant a little bag or pouch, usually of leather. Pilgrimage in the Middle Ages was no haphazard affair, to be undertaken at the drop of a hat. Before making the journey, certain important matters had to be attended to. Debts must be settled, and any outstanding disputes resolved. A will must be drawn up, naming eventual heirs and detailing the purpose of the pilgrimage, destination and intended length of time away. The pilgrim had to obtain permission from his overlord, bishop or abbot if he were a monk. If approved, he would be given a letter of commendation, which he must carry with him. This was important, as it showed he was not a vagrant. It made him eligible for the privileges of a pilgrim, such as arms and lodgings, and it was a definite status symbol. Finally, it was essential for the pilgrim to receive the church's blessing before he could go on his way rejoicing. Indeed, there was a specially written consecration ceremony, followed by the ceremonial adornment of the subject in the recognised pilgrim's garb. Sarah Hopper recounts.
This religious ceremony, which commended the pilgrim to God and to service as a pilgrim, was called the Ordo ad Servitium Peregrinorum. The subject would be blessed along with each article of pilgrimage that would go with the pilgrim. The Sarum Missal, written between 1150 and 1319, included the Mass and blessing to be performed for this purpose. The Almighty and Everlasting God, who is the way, the truth, and the life, dispose your journey according to his good pleasure. Send his angel Raphael to keep you in this your pilgrimage, and both conduct you in peace on your way to the place where you would be, and bring you back again on your return to us in safety.
After making his confession, the pilgrim prostrated himself in front of the altar. With the congregation as witness, pilgrim status was then conferred on him through consecration of his scrip and staff, sprinkled with holy water and placed correctly on his person. The cloak of the pilgrim to Jerusalem was adorned with a red cross at the shoulder. Often pilgrims were escorted to the city gates or just outside the town by members of the village, guild or brotherhood, who sometimes even made a small donation in the hope of sharing somewhat in the merit of the pilgrimage. And having seen him on his way, let us bid farewell to our medieval pilgrim, thankful, perhaps, that we are not so hemmed round with precepts and usages. But, as John Adair writes in conclusion,
we should be wise to refrain from looking down upon the beliefs and practices of those pilgrims who travel to the saints' shrines. For we are spiritual wayfarers also, and we may well reflect upon the old English proverb, God knows well who are the best pilgrims.
Many thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voices you've just heard. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.